Humans have always found the objects in the night sky a source of mystery and wonder. Now, with inexpensive, high-powered equipment, anybody can investigate them by becoming an amateur astronomer, even in the horrible observing conditions of the New York City area. Joining me now for Please Explain Amateur Astronomy are Robert Bruce Thompson, co-author of The Illustrated Guide to Astronomical Wonders, which is published by O'Reilly, and Richard Rosenberg, president of the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thanks, Leonard. It's good to be here.
And Bob, what is the first step to becoming an amateur astronomer?
Well, there's a lot of ways to look at that, but I think probably if you're interested in seeing the wonders of the night sky, the best thing that you can do is get hooked up with your local astronomy club.
And, well, if there is one, if you know that there is one, do you just look in the yellow pages?
Mm-hmm. You can look Sky and Telescope magazine on their website. Skyandtelescope.com has a link to resources, and one of those resources is a list, not just the United States, but worldwide, of astronomy clubs, planetariums, observatories, and so forth, and it's searchable, so you can find all of the clubs in your city, or if you're out in the far west or something where cities are fewer and farther between, just in the whole state.
Rich, what about the New York area? Are there a lot of these clubs?
Well, we're the only significant club in the city. There are a number of clubs in Long Island. There's a club in Westchester, a few in Jersey, and a few further up in New York. So there are plenty, but we are the largest club in New York City by far.
Bob, what's the hardest part about becoming an amateur astronomer?
I think it's getting discouraged, although nowadays you can buy scopes, the go-to scopes that will actually locate objects for you. A lot of amateurs getting into the game start out with inexpensive instruments, and just finding objects. Once you go out and you look at the moon and maybe you spot Jupiter or Saturn, pointed elsewhere, and there's just a whole bunch of stars, and people invariably hit this learning curve and find that they're unable to locate objects or that they're unable to see objects, particularly because of light pollution and so forth, and it can get pretty discouraging.
Rich, what advice do you have for beginning astronomers?
I think most beginners get in trouble because they try to do it themselves, and they have no idea of what's involved. And really, there are a lot of skills, not difficult skills, but things that have to be learned. And if you go into astronomy and you take it seriously and you decide to get a telescope, and I think that might be the first mistake for a lot of people. I'll elaborate on that later. But if you're going to get a telescope, you have to realize what that involves. You have to consider how bulky it is, you know, so that if you look it around, is it complex to set up? Right? Is the learning curve going to be too difficult for you? A lot of people don't think in terms of minimizing. They think in terms of getting a very expensive scope, which is often the most difficult to use.
And they get the most expensive one because they want to see the most.
Yes, which is certainly understandable. Generally speaking, you see the most when you have a large, what we call the aperture of the scope. That is to say, the light collecting area. The people get hung up on magnification, and magnification has its points, but to me, it's much less important than the aperture, the light gathering ability of a telescope.
Now, Bob, you don't live in a big city. Does that make it easier for you? Is that how you got involved with amateur astronomy?
It makes it easier in one sense. I actually got involved in amateur astronomy back in the, well, I was going to say early 60s, but it actually, for me, started when I was very young with the Sputnik launch in the late 50s. And, of course, back then, even large cities were much less light polluted than they are now. I live in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, which is a city is about 250,000, and the metro area is a couple million. And the only way that it's better for us in a smaller city than it is for folks in New York City is that we can drive a shorter distance to get to darker skies. Our light pollution is just as bad in urban Winston-Salem as it is in urban New York, probably. But we can drive for half an hour and get to not totally dark, but reasonably dark skies, whereas in New York City it's more difficult, or you have to drive longer to get to skies as good.
Well, is it my imagination? But I've noticed that you see fewer stars nowadays in the countryside as well.
Oh, absolutely. Light pollution has become so pervasive throughout. If you look at a night map of the United States showing the whole continent, the far west, Utah, Wyoming, and so forth, Colorado, with few exceptions, are black on that map, whereas the East Coast is lit up. You can actually see the outline of the United States coast because of all the lights. And, of course, for observing the moon or observing planets, light pollution isn't an issue because they're very bright. But if you want to look at some of the magnificent nebulae and galaxies and so forth, they're just overwhelmed by local light pollution and general light pollution. So it's important to get as far as you can from it.
Isn't there a dark sky preservation movement?
Yes, there is an organization.
What do they do? Tell everybody to turn out the lights?
Well, basically what they're arguing is not, you know, do this for our benefit, that is for the benefit of amateur astronomers. They're saying do it for your own benefit because so much, a huge proportion of the light and of the power and the electricity and the money that's spent on it goes to lighting that does absolutely no good. It's simply pointed up in the air. So what the International Dark Sky Association lobbies for is various forward-looking communities have realized that they're not just polluting the sky with light, they're actually wasting a lot of money, and by using more efficient lighting and by what are called full cutoff fixtures, that is, ones that direct the light down onto the ground rather than allowing it to go up into the air, that they can do everybody good. The night sky is visible again, and they actually save money because the power bill is a lot lower.
With me on Please Explain Today are Robert Bruce Thompson, co-author of The Illustrated Guide to Astronomical Wonders, and Richard Rosenberg, president of the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Rich, where does your group go to view the night sky in New York?
Well, we have a number of locations in New York City. We're everywhere from Inwood Hill Park in northern Manhattan, the very northern tip of Manhattan, to Carl Schurz Park at the end of 86th Street.
And that has less light pollution?
There are two reasons that we choose sites, one of which is having relatively less light pollution. That's true of Inwood Park. The other is, quite frankly, to reach out to the public. That's true of Carl Schurz Park. Also, we have a location at Cabin Plaza in downtown Brooklyn. These are, even for New York City, poor locations to see faint objects, but we get a lot of people that come up and get introduced to astronomy and see objects in the telescope for the first time. They see the moon, they'll see Saturn or Jupiter, see a few double stars, for example, and get excited.
Well, how much can you observe with the naked eye?
In New York City?
Yeah.
In New York City, well, of course, you have the moon and you have the brighter planets, Venus, Jupiter. Right now, Mars is approaching opposition and is very bright. Saturn is also up and is easily seen with the naked eye. All these are quite bright.
But you have to know what you're looking at, otherwise you might think that Mars is just some star.
Yes, actually Mars is somewhat unique this time because
it's
getting so bright and it's so unique color. It's a reddish or ruddy color. It makes it unique if you know it. Again, if you don't know much, you'll have no idea other than the moon.
And it's brighter than it's probably been in my lifetime?
It was brightest rather famously 4 years ago, two oppositions ago. Mars is brightest when the Earth lies in between Mars and the Sun, and that's when it's closest to us. And 4 years ago was actually its closest in tens of thousands of years, and they made a big fuss over it. And it's not quite as close this time around, but it's still very good, and it's dramatically how it brightens.
Now, Rich, you said that people go out and buy expensive equipment, and that's the first mistake they make. Can binoculars be used for observing?
Absolutely. This is, I think, the main point I'd like to make. And there are good binoculars that can be had, absolutely fine, 10 by 50s for $100. And, again, they're lightweight. You need knowledge. You need to know a little bit about the sky. And there are many sources to obtain this knowledge, because you'll be flailing about the sky, occasionally stumbling upon something interesting. But, you know, you're pretty much lost without picking up a little knowledge.
And Bob, I assume you also suggest starting with binoculars.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the mistakes beginners commonly make is to assume that binoculars are something you use until you can afford a telescope, when in fact, if you go to a star party and look around at the experienced amateur astronomers, what you'll find is nearly all of them have a binocular around their necks. And in fact, there are many amateur astronomers who own telescopes but seldom use them because they prefer observing with binoculars. A binocular is by no means inferior to a telescope. It's simply different. It has a much wider field of view. It doesn't gather as much light, so you can't see the dimmest or the smallest objects with it. But there are many magnificent objects in the night sky that if you use a telescope, it's very narrow field of view, like looking through a drinking straw, basically. You can't see the forest. All you see is the individual trees.
You make it sound like we shouldn't...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You make it sound like we shouldn't even bother thinking about telescopes.
Oh, no, not at all. We use both. Ordinarily, on a given night of observing, we'll be using the binocular, sometimes just to observe particular objects that are very large. Many people would be shocked to learn that there are many objects in the night sky that are actually larger than the full moon. And, you know, first impression is, well, where is it then? You know, why can't we see it? And you can't see it because it's dim. It's large, but it's not bright enough to be obvious to the naked eye, whereas with binocular, it gathers enough additional light that you can see these objects.
What if you were suggesting a good telescope for beginners, what kind should they look into?
Well, that's everybody's question. I want to go out and buy a scope. Tell me what to buy. I want to buy it now. And as Rich said, one of the big mistakes people do is... go start ready. What they need to do before they even think about buying a telescope is first do a little bit of research. Although our book is primarily a field observing guide, it does include a fairly detailed chapter on choosing equipment. There are also numerous other books. Phil Harrington's book, Starware, is an excellent choice. It's an entire book devoted to how to choose the proper equipment. But even more than that, go to your local astronomy club, and you'll get some hands-on experience. You'll be able to actually see things before you order them or before you run down to the 57th Street Photo or whatever to buy it. You'll also be able to get good, unbiased, honest advice, because amateur astronomers aren't in, you know, they're not in the business of selling telescopes and equipment, and if they bought something that's bad, they'll tell you it's bad. They'll say that's a waste of money. On the other hand, they'll give you good advice about the best scopes and eyepieces and other equipment to start out with, which is why we say over and over again, the first thing to do is get yourself to your local astronomy club.
You wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I'd like to second almost everything that he said. I would mention also a great site is the Sky and Telescope magazine site, skyandtelescope.com. It has a thorough discussion of equipment, binoculars and telescopes, and really goes into all the issues in using them and all discusses all the different types of telescopes.
Well, what other things does an amateur astronomer need? What about red flashlights? I've heard about that.
Red flashlight. If you're in New York City, forget about red flashlights. Red flashlights are used to preserve people's vision. Our pupil expands as we're in a dark environment and we see more. So when we're in a very dark site, observing at the stars, we usually actually wait a while, perhaps a half an hour while we're setting up to let our pupils expand. And so we can see, when we look in a telescope or through our binoculars, we can see more. And if somebody shines a bright light near us, we get angry. However, in New York City, it's not an issue because there is so much ambient light that forget about it. And it's kind of amusing that we have sometimes a new person who out of principle gets upset when a bright light is flashed. And you know, the rule, I think the simple rule is if you can see the person next to you, it's too bright to worry about ambient light.
Do you need a night sky chart?
Absolutely. I know there are go-to scopes now, which I absolutely think are great. They enable you, in theory at least, to not even know anything about the sky and just look at three objects, I believe it is, and then in theory the The computer behind the scope is knows how to get to any object you desire. I don't know how that particular version works. I know I do have a go-to scope, a little more primitive, one of the first versions, and you have to be careful with things, or things won't align perfectly. In any case, you really should get a little knowledge of how the sky, the constellations and the stars and the interesting objects that you want to look for, where they're positioned in the sky. For example, you might be looking for an object that isn't even up. You might be looking for an object that's seen in the summer and it's wintertime, for example. So it's actually, I think, a fun aspect of the job is learning the sky.
Bob, your book includes the 50 major constellations. I'm curious about simple stuff, like what's the difference between a cluster, a galaxy, and a nebula?
Well, basically, astronomers categorize different what are called DSOs, deep space objects or deep sky objects, into several categories. Star clusters, open clusters, are fairly young groupings of stars, and some of them are tiny, faint little things that you really need to be at a dark site and have a large aperture telescope to see. But some of them are, for instance, the Pleiades, most people are familiar with, are very large and very bright. There are globular clusters, which are ancient. They're nearly as old as the universe itself, and they're very tight, gravitationally bound collections of millions of stars. Nebulae are generally huge clouds of gas and dust that either shine by their own emitted light because they're excited by a nearby star, or reflect light from a nearby star. Planetary nebulae are basically dead stars. They're stars that have gone through the process, the lifespan of a star, and exploded. And the explosion is on a huge scale, gives off gigantic clouds of dust and gas that expand, and depending on how we're looking at it, it may be anything. Some of them look like an apple with a bite taken out of it. Others look like a little smoke ring. Supernova remnants are basically similar in appearance to planetary nebulae, but they're from a supernova as opposed to a nova, which is just an incredibly gigantic explosion. So there are many types, and sometimes it's difficult to tell exactly what type of object you're looking at. For instance, a galaxy may be just a rounded patch of light, and it may appear just pretty much like a globular cluster. So part of the fun is to discover, to delve into this, to discover the nature of the objects you're looking at, to learn more about them.
And Rich, can we spot all these different kinds of things in New York?
Well, yes, we can, with the exception of galaxies. They're just too faint, even with telescopes. In New York, you can definitely see one galaxy, the famous Andromeda Galaxy, which is close enough and bright enough and large enough from Earth to see easily, even with binoculars. But you won't be able to see any other galaxies with binoculars, and you'd need a fairly powerful telescope to see any other galaxies. But all the other objects you can see, samples of from New York City.
Well, some amateur astronomers have recently made important discoveries. They're not using binoculars, are they? They're not looking out into the sky in major cities, are they?
I don't think so. Hmm. But they do use binoculars. There are people who do discover comets. In fact, Yakutake, you remember the famous comet around 10 years ago, was discovered by large, giant binoculars. Yeah.
There's a very luminous comet, isn't there, the Holmes comet?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, its luminosity is largely a thing of the past. But in late October, it suddenly brightened almost a factor of a million, which was amazing. And it grew. It just grew in size.
Do we know why that happened?
Well, no doubt there was water and other what we call ice, I should say, and other volatiles that evaporated and took with them gas and just became a shell surrounding it. I suspect, this is my own notion, that the body itself, the comet itself, was the volatiles were embedded in the comet, and it lost its structural integrity, and basically it collapsed, which exposed more volatiles, which in turn evaporated and contributing to more breakdown of the object. And what the result was this huge spherical body which was lit up by a light from the sun, and it just grew and grew and grew, and actually over the course of a few weeks eventually became bigger than the sun. You could, with a telescope, actually see this object, which is a little further than the sun from us. It actually is bigger in size than the sun, and in reality it is bigger than the sun. Incredible.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, we will continue this conversation and take your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are Richard Rosenberg and Robert Bruce Thompson. We're talking about amateur astronomy on today's Please Explain.
We lived our little drama. We kissed in a field of white. And stars fell on Alabama last night.
We're back with Robert Bruce Thompson, co-author of Illustrated Guide to Astronomical Wonders, which is published by O'Reilly, and Richard Rosenberg, president of the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York. And before we get going with listener calls at 212-433-9692, I wanted to tell you about two events that are sponsored by the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York. You can find them on our show page. There's also a slideshow of comets and constellations and a link to What's in the Sky. And before we get to those calls, Bob, what is really interesting in the sky right now?
Oh, it's winter, which is the best time of year. The one object I think that all amateur astronomers would agree is the most magnificent object in the night sky is the Great Nebula of Orion. It's a gigantic cloud of dust. It's actually visible to the naked eye if you have sharp vision as a kind of a fuzzy star. Most people can recognize the constellation Orion, and it looks like a giant hourglass. Right now it rises not too long after dark, and there are three vertical stars that form a vertical line in the middle, and then that's the belt of Orion, and then below and to the right of that as it rises you'll see the sword of Orion, and the middle star in the sword is looks kind of fuzzy, and that's the Great Orion Nebula. It's something that I don't think there's ever been an evening that we've been out that Orion Nebula has been up that we haven't spent at least some time looking at it. And at times we've spent hours literally studying it. It's just, there's so much detail in it, it's incredible.
We have posted a picture of it on our website. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I could mention a few other things. There are some wonderful star clusters that are easily visible. The Pleiades was mentioned before, I think. And they're visible to the naked eye if you look carefully. You can find them by following the belt that Bob mentioned. Follow it to the upper right. You'll come to a bright star called Aldebaran. And if you continue more or less in the same direction, look for a group of stars. They're kind of close together, may actually appear hazy. They're called the Pleiades. There's another group surrounding Aldebaran, another star cluster, a wider one, larger one called the Hyades as well. These are particularly lovely in binoculars.
We're taking calls at 212-433-9692. Fernando from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
How are you? Long-time listener, first-time caller. I have a very long fascination with the sky. Just wanted to know if... I'm sure you guys heard of Google Earth, and now there's, I believe, Google Sky. If... people do actually use the sky as a source for finding planets and and stars and things like that. I'll listen to your answers off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Yes, actually, Google Earth and now Google Sky is extremely useful for amateur astronomers, particularly for casual astronomers. If you want to find out what's up at the moment or what will be up, say, this Saturday evening, you can use Google Sky to isolate it to your location, because where you are has an effect on what's up when. And, for instance, if you want to see what planets are up, you can use Google Sky to say, okay, you know, at 9 o'clock this evening, is there anything going to be visible? Or, as Rich was saying, if you want to determine exactly where the Pleiades are, you can say, okay, you know, look on Google Sky, and it'll tell you the azimuth, that is the compass direction, and about how high up in, you know, 90 degrees is straight overhead and 0 degrees is the horizon. So if at a particular time it says that the Pleiades are located just a little bit north of east and, 30 degrees elevation, you can kind of just look in the general area and find it pretty easily that way.
Are we seeing the same sky that you're seeing in Winston-Salem?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. In terms of when a particular object rises, yes, because we're at about the same longitude. In terms of what's visible south and north, no, we can see we're south of you by a few degrees. So our view of the southern sky, we can see objects that would be below the horizon in New York.
Let's take some more calls. Is it Panders from Morristown? Hi, you're on
Pandora.
The air. Pandora. Wow.
Hi.
That's a dangerous name.
Sure. Not unless you're curious. I want to know more about these dark things that are objects as big as the moon, but they're dark and we can't see them. What are you talking about? Where are they?
Well, for example, one of them, Rich mentioned earlier, is the Andromeda Galaxy. It actually, depending on the size of objects is always a matter of opinion, because in a long exposure photograph from a dark site, they may look a lot larger than they do, say, in a binocular. But the Andromeda Galaxy is considerably larger than the full moon. There are other nebulae and so forth that, well, for instance, the Vale Nebula in Cygnus, which isn't up at the moment, is considerably larger than the full moon. But again, these objects are so dim that in the absence of some optical aid, sometimes a binocular or a larger telescope, there's just not enough light for you to see them naked eye.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for calling us. A listener wants to know, Rich, why he can't see the Lockheed constellation in the New York skies anymore.
The airplane?
I don't know. It says, why can't I see the Lockheed constellation? Oh, that was a joke. Okay.
He's giving you a hard time.
He's giving me a hard time, and I'm such a literalist and so unknowledgeable. That was a funny joke. Okay. Hilarious. Jeff from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask about satellites. Seeing man-made objects in the sky.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, there's a tremendous site called heavensabove.com. I believe it's a hyphen between heavens and above.
It is.
And it will give you for your location. You give it your location, and it will tell you satellites that are going to pass overhead.
One of the things that Heavens Above lists is iridium flares. Mm-hmm. And the iridium satellites, they have large solar collection arrays that of cells that power them, and they're extremely reflective. And the flare of an iridium can be literally, other than the full moon, the brightest object in the night sky. It gets down to magnitude minus 7, minus 8. But the interesting thing is that the flares are only visible on a very specific path. So if you check heavensabove.com, one of the items that you'll see is a list of forthcoming iridium flares for, I think, the next 24 hours. And the first time you see an iridium flare, you won't believe it. It's all of a sudden you notice an object that say, hey, that's getting brighter. And then all of a sudden it's like an oncoming train's light. It just lights things up. It's very interesting. And of course, Heavens Above also lists the International Space Station and many other satellites that are visible, and it localizes them, because visibility of these objects depends on where you happen to be. Somebody 20 miles from you may not be able to see them at all. Particularly the iridium flares are a good example of that, and it allows you to select by brightness so that you can choose to only have it list very bright objects.
Let's go now to Paul from New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
I might start off by mentioning that I've been in amateur astronomy about 32 years, and as a New Yorker.
Oh, boy.
That's rough. Although I was out in the boroughs for the bulk of that time, and I was able to see a considerably good portion of the sky without any of the contemporary obscurities, the clouds and whatever, pollution lights. I just thought I'd call and give a couple of tips to anyone who's interested in astronomy as a beginner. The first thing, I think the most important thing, is don't sit at the table and eat the entire meal at once in a hurry. Take it slow. Pick up a few things here, a few things there. Try to get into some sort of course. I believe the Hayden Planetarium, which no one mentioned yet. Am I correct?
We haven't mentioned it, but we were going to.
Yeah, the Hayden Planetarium offers some options in that regard. Also, the public library is a terrific, terrific resource. Sky and Telescope, as you mentioned, there are some of the larger magazines still around. The thing is that the beginner should, you know, male or female, doesn't matter, it's open to all, should have the first and most important asset, which is patience, because astronomy can be a very enjoyable thing as well as a very frustrating thing.
Yeah, my guest actually said that when we started, because I guess that is one of the most important things. And since kids get involved in astronomy, they get all excited about astronomy, how do you develop that patience in them? Rich?
Well, because they have to develop that themselves, but you can help them. Basically, they get excited right away, and you show them a few things. Now, not having any children myself, don't have that personal ideas, but I see families that come, and usually very often the father or the mother is very anxious to promote the interest in their child. And I kind of actually give similar advice to take it easy. Don't try to do too much. Just keep attending sessions where, you know, you can find people who are observing and ask questions. And if you, usually after a few years, if the child is, say 9 or 10, you can give a starting scope.
And Bob, are there any books that you would recommend or websites for beginning astronomy with children?
There are numerous books devoted to children and astronomy, anything from elementary school on up. But I know I keep hammering on this, but I think if your child expresses an interest in astronomy, the first thing that I would do is contact the local astronomy club. Most astronomy clubs have periodic public observations. There's a group founded by a guy called John Dobson that actually invented a type of scope that's now very widely used among amateur astronomers. And he started a group called Sidewalk Astronomers. And I believe there is an active group of sidewalk astronomers in New York that they literally set up telescopes on the sidewalk and show things to people. And via getting the kids actually out under the night sky is the important thing, because it's all well and good to read books from the library and watch shows on television about it, but actually getting out into the night sky with an astronomy club or an enthusiastic amateur who knows a bit about the subject and show the kids things. Rich and I get excited about looking at stuff that the average person would look through the eyepiece and literally not see anything. Whereas when we have 4 times a year, we run a public observation at Pilot Mountain, just north of us, and we have hundreds and sometimes thousands of people show up at these public observations, and they're not going to appreciate the dim stuff that kind of is an acquired taste, is a connoisseur's thing. What they want to look at is things like the moon and the planets. A kid's first look at Saturn, for example.
Well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. There are 2 events sponsored by the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York on our show page, a slideshow as well. My great thanks to Robert Bruce Thompson, co-author with his wife of Illustrated Guide to Astronomical Wonders, published by O'Reilly, and to Richard Rosenberg, the president of the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York. It's been a great pleasure talking with both of you on today's Please Explain.
Thank you.
Thank you.